With that being said, we'll call the next case, which is case number 76228, Janet Solander versus the State of Nevada. We have Ms. Niemus and Mr. Figler representing the appellant, Mr. Hamner representing the respondent. Ms. Niemus, would you like to reserve any time in rebuttal?
Yes, we would like to reserve 3 minutes, please.
Okay, very well. Then you'll see the clock on the video screen, and when you get the 3 minutes, if you'd stop, and then we'll have that reserved for you, and we'll go ahead and proceed with the respondent after that then. So, okay, and Ms. Mann, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Caitlin McNamis, and with me is Attorney David Figler, and together we represent appellant Janet Solander. We wanted to alert the court that we will be splitting our arguments. I will be presenting primarily, and then Mr. Figler's arguments will solely address the sexual assault issues, and we've reserved 3 minutes in rebuttal. Your Honorable Justices, this is a case that involves a very novel prosecution of sexual assault in a manner that's never been done before in Clark County, and we would say Nevada, and it resulted in an overzealous prosecution of both Janet and Dwight Solander, an interracial couple who married, who fostered and then adopted a sibling group of three girls who had a history on their own of being physically abused by biological family members, had a history of bedwetting issues, self-soiling, self-destructive type behavior. And so when those girls were then placed with Janet Solander, a woman who raised four of her own biological issues without any CPS intervention in her life, that's when this prosecution took note, and that's how it came to this court's attention today. Your Honors, we would submit that one of the biggest fundamental flaws in the way that Janet Solander's trial denied her due process was the admission of the bad act evidence. Specifically, for the first week and a half of this multi-week trial, the state's presentation of witness after witness served only to paint Janet Solander in a bizarre way, in a crazy way, in a way that was to paint her solely as a monster to these foster children who were all depicting their own different issues. These were foster children who came to her care who had not been toilet trained, who came from homes without running water, without running electricity. And so her ways of trying to organize a multi-functional household in which she has anywhere between 5 and 9 children in the home, including those three adopted daughters, that her efforts to try to toilet train, to try to offer structure, to pre-section the toilet paper, to try to offer only nutritious meals, and to focus on what those children were ingesting, were eating, and then take them to the doctors for treatment, for medical follow-up, as was her duty to both her adoptive daughters and part of her parental responsibility for those adopted daughters, as well as the legal function that she served for the foster children.
So are you saying that it was overly, I mean, what part of the prongs are we looking at? That it wasn't relevant evidence, that they didn't meet a clear and convincing standard, or is your argument to us that it was overly prejudicial than it was probative?
Thank you, Justice. It's our position that the first and the third prongs are the ones most at issue. So when we talk about relevance for bad acts, it needs to be relevant in that it's the same type of behaviors, but same type of like criminal type conduct. The issue that we have with the relevance in this case is that in the initial bad acts motion, it was presented as like a hyper-focused similarity of issues, and then at trial it was turned around of Janet treats one set of the fosters this way and her adopted children the other way. And so
didn't they also say it was for motive for her, for financial gain as far as getting more money if they were deemed special needs? Wasn't that also argued in the bad acts for relevancy?
While it was presented that way, there was no evidence that Janet Solander ever actually received additional money. None of these children were determined to be medically fragile, requiring that additional stipend. So while it was available, most of Janet Solander's focus was on trying to meet the medical needs of the children in her care. And so it was, while it was presented one way, there was no actual evidence that she got financial benefits. And so if I could turn then to the third prong with the court's permission, because of that misconstruing of how Ms. Solander treated the foster children as compared to her adopted children, that's created an issue of more prejudicial than probative, because there was so much just cumulative evidence about how the foster children were treated one way and her adopted children were treated a different way, not factoring in that the adopted children were withholding their urine, were presenting with behavioral issues. And so Ms. Solander, in her overwhelmed state as both a mother to these children and a foster mother to these other children, trying to set parameters to give them parental guidance, to set them up for success in the future. And so when you look at, you know, hyper-focusing on, as the state's trying to paint it, on what snacks they're providing, that's not a bad act. It's not... It's presented only as trying to hyper-focus on controlling what the therapist was giving the foster kids, when really she spent so much time trying to monitor nutritional needs of her daughters, taking them regularly for medical appointments in which doctors evaluated and said that these were not malnourished or...
Ms. McCandish? Sorry, it's Justice Carson. I don't even know where I am on the screen. But the conduct that you're taking issue with that was admitted, or the evidence, is so benign when you compare it to the evidence of how she treated the adopted children. How can you say that the admission of that, of the evidence about the other foster children was so prejudicial vis-a-vis what happened to the children who are the focus of the complaint?
You're saying that it is so prejudicial because of the volume of it, because of how it paints Janet as a bizarre or perhaps crazy or perhaps just out of control person who is doing this for her own like volitional gain, and it completely ignores all of the other evidence that was presented, that Ms. Solander had to comply with CPS, had the Department of Family Services caseworkers in her home. And so this behavior... Sorry.
But are you suggesting then in the absence of that testimony, these counts would have been resolved differently by a jury? I mean, because that's,
yes.
You know, is it that, you think it's that damning that we would have had a different result given the evidence of her conduct with the named victims?
And Your Honor, believe that. And specifically, we believe that because when you look at our argument in Section 2 relating to the child abuse or neglect or endangerment involving the eldest daughter, specifically, expressly recanting her testimony that she was never forced to lick urine off of the toilet in Count 11, the jury was so inundated with that bad act evidence that they turned a blind eye to actual disavowalment under oath of that eldest daughter saying, no, I said that out of anger. I said that at the preliminary hearing, but it was a lie. I am under oath telling you the truth now. And that's why we think that's the evidence where Ms. Solander was so prejudiced, because there wasn't a count-by-count evaluation of the sufficiency of the evidence, because there's so much time was spent on the weirdness or the difference or whatever distinctions were drawn relating to the foster children. And then I would also submit that when you look at the extended periods of time under the counts involving child abuse or neglect endangerment related to the potty counts, that's not in any way legally sufficient or puts a parent on notice of what conduct is being charged as criminal when we were looking at parents who withhold food to modify correct behavior, limit timeouts, or extend timeouts. And so for those reasons, we are asking that you find that there's prejudice as well, because there was no evaluation. Additionally, with the prosecutorial misconduct, Ms. Jacqueline Bluth entering into that jury box, trying to put herself in, vouching for those young children who testified. We are asking for those considerations as prejudice as well. And with that, I would ask to turn to Mr. Figler on the sexual assault.
Thank you, Justices. NRS 200-366 and by construction NRS 200-364 subsection 9 are inherently problematic, especially under the codified versions of those laws in effect when the alleged conduct at issue occurred, especially with fact patterns like this. Indeed, both the district court and this court grappled with potential limitations on a strict application of the words of the statute, with an alleged penetration devoid of any sexual intent by a parent using a medical tool in the functional design it was intended on the part of the body where the medical tool was designed to go.
But Mr. Figler, wasn't Doesn't instruction number 10, the one that Judge Adair ultimately gave, allow the jury to pick which version it wants to go with that? Was the sexual assault, was it motivated by something other than, you know, something that was legally or medically permissible? I mean, doesn't, it appears that they have to make that factual determination within that instruction.
With due respect, Your Honor, Instruction 10 did not do that because of the injection of the word legitimate over objection from the defense into the standard. In other words, what the court did was engage in ad hoc lawmaking by inserting this new element. That did not naturally follow from your court's determination of the reversal of the dismissal of these counts in the first place. On the state's appeal of the trial court's ruling, this court, in allowing the prosecutors to expand the scope of the statute in an unprecedented way, explicitly carved out an exemption, supposedly leaving it to the jury to determine if facts supported what Your Honor said in that order, a bona fide medical, hygiene, or law enforcement purpose. And I would also suggest that the court order seemed to leave open for the jury these other questions of consent, lack of mens rea, and necessity as defenses. And while I understand that this court wanted to defer to the jury, the problem is that this court did not give an appropriate instruction. We offered in our proposed instructions a language that came from this court's order that talked about the parental function, that didn't put that qualification of legitimate medical, because legitimate is neither defined, nor would a reasonable jury perhaps think that a parent can sua sponte decide what is legitimate given an urgency that parent is dealing with, in this case, the withholding of the urine. And so it was our
Mr. Figler, but didn't Instruction 10 also said a reasonable and good faith belief? So it gives her an opportunity to say, hey, I reasonably believe this was necessary, or why isn't that sufficient to augment what you're talking about?
Thank you, Your Honor. And I think that Instruction 10 then, with regard to that good faith, is thereafter limited by Instruction number 16 that the court gave, which would not have been a problem if our instruction was able to go forward, that talked about any medical purpose and essentially allowed a parent who may have very different emotions going into doing a medical procedure in tune with the way that the medical tool was devised to go forward with it. So I think that in addition to Ms. McGamis's argument that by that point the jury was already tainted and weren't going to consider anything good faith or legitimate, that the good faith exception that was put into Instruction 10 is then taken away with the other hand in Instruction 16 by talking about acts of force, violence, menacing, and the such. So there, we do want to reserve the rest of the time with regard to rebuttal, Your Honors. But bottom line, I just wanted to say that there is a spectrum of exemption to the explicit language that this court carved out. Without a proper instruction, what we had was the chaos of the trial where we were trying to grapple with the appropriate instruction. It included language that shouldn't have been there, that was not consistent with this court's opinion. And with that, I yield the rest of the time for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Figler. Okay, Mr. Hamner, are you ready to go? Mm-hmm.
I am.
Okay, you may proceed. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. As the court is well aware, the standard of review when you're challenging things like the sufficiency of the evidence is that this court is not really supposed to be stepping into the shoes of the jury to assess the evidence. When there is substantial evidence for a verdict, the law in this state is quite clear that that verdict should not be disturbed. I bring this up because when you start to turn to the issues that have been raised here, and we can start in the order that was kind of discussed by the defense, when you deal with the evidence of the bad acts, it's clear that those bad acts were relevant. They were proven by clear and convincing evidence, and as the justices have appropriately noted, the evidence regarding bad acts involving those foster kids, it was not so overwhelming that it outweighed kind of the evidence that you heard about the actual adoptive kids in that house. You had a ruling by the district court, and the And again, it's an abuse of discretion standard where you're not going to be changing that unless you did something manifestly wrong. The district court in this case didn't give us whole cloth everything that the state requested. It actually narrowly tailored it down. And the issues that came up were very important. Issues with an obsession on toileting, issues and obsession on food, issues potentially about potential illnesses that the kids had. All of these things were relevant because, as the state noted, it tied into the defenses that were being raised, which were these adoptive kids, they're liars, they're problems, they're medically sensitive. But when you have other children starting to testify, you know, we had some of these guidelines placed upon us that were somewhat similar. We also were starting to have toileting issues, but once we left the house, they all went away. You know, my foster parents believed I might have a potential illness, but once I left, I never had any of those. Those were really relevant in order to evaluate the credibility of the adoptive kids and to rebut the defense that was being raised. So with respect to the bad acts argument, there was nothing improper about the district court's ruling. There was a relevant purpose for it, and I agree with Justice Stiglitz that the scope and the level of the evidence was so benign comparatively to the things that Ms. Solander was actually doing to her own children, having them sit on buckets for entire days, having them sit in garbage cans where they defecate on themselves, inserting catheters into their vaginas just when she suspects they might have to go to the bathroom, having them sleep on boards, having them take ice showers. These are the things that the jury heard with respect to the adopted kids, not the foster children. And the state would submit that Justice Stiglitz is correct, that if you had removed this ruling, the result would have been the same. And additionally, these foster kids were percipient witnesses as to what was happening in the house. And the district court made a good point. It said, you know, there may be a time where if they start talking about the toileting restrictions on these adoptive kids, the jury might naturally prompt the question, well, did you have any toileting restrictions? Because she could see that a lot of this would be really being able to give the jury a complete story of the crime. So with respect to that issue, unless the justices have any questions on that, I'd like to kind of turn my attention then to the sexual assault issue. Turning to sexual assault, again, the argument that's being raised here that these statutes are problematic, number one, from a constitutional perspective, which was already addressed in this court's previous ruling. So essentially, that's all law of the case. There is nothing ambiguous about this statute. In 2015, the legislature added a medical exception, which in this case, the state provided to Ms. Solander. And Justice Silver is correct. They had to make that factual determination. It's not as if this issue wasn't raised. From the very start, the defense's argument was these are medically sensitive kids and these were all legitimate reasons to control this out-of-control toileting issue. It was one of the primary arguments raised by Ms. Solander in her trial. And that instruction that was provided was an accurate statement of the law. And what happened in this case, when the jury considered the testimony of all three of these girls, when the jury saw the orders for the catheters, when they saw the photographs that Janet is sending Dwight showing filled catheter bags full of urine, when they heard one of the foster children talk about, no, I heard them talking about threatening to use the catheters on the kids, when they heard from Ms. Solander's biological daughter, yes, my mom used these on these kids, and I couldn't bring myself to watch her do it. Those are the reasons why this jury made a determination, at least in the state's opinion, that there wasn't a bona fide or legitimate medical purpose for this, and they rejected it. But they have the instruction that enabled them to consider this possible defense. And so, therefore, if you turn to the sufficiency argument being raised, it's simply not there. They claim that the Solander girls weren't corroborated, but when you review the record, number one, the girls corroborate themselves. Additionally, you had a foster child who witnessed these conversations and these threats between Janet and these children regarding the catheters. You had Ms. Solander's own biological daughter testify that her mother did this to these kids. And she didn't deny that. She saw the catheters, she saw that she was doing, and she couldn't bring herself to watch it. And then lastly, you had emails and photographic evidence that they had ordered these catheters, and then 5 days later, they're using them. All of that information sufficiently established why the jury found Ms. Solander guilty on every one of these sexual assault counts with respect to a catheter. With respect to the jury instruction argument, again, the state's position is that the instruction that was provided was an accurate statement of the law. When we deal with the two proposed instructions, the first one that the defense had, or the appellant had provided, once again tried to reintroduce a scienter requirement in needing sexual behavior or libidinal gratification, which was rejected by this court when reinstituting these sexual assault counts. And then additionally, the second proposed instruction really tries to deal with kind of a mistake of fact. But as the justices have properly noted, the instruction that we provided accurately established the exception that was carved out by the legislature. And so it was not inappropriate for the trial court to reject this proposed instruction. And again, the standard review there is it's an abuse of discretion. And I don't think the state would submit, the appellants have not made a showing that the denial of that second instruction was some sort of manifestly wrong abuse of discretion, particularly when that instruction that was provided gave them the ability to argue there was a legitimate medical purpose for doing this. If there's any other topics or there's any questions these justices have for the respondent, I'm happy to answer them. I know there's a lot of time left, but I'm willing to field any particular questions, because at the end of the day, this month-long trial, the evidence was overwhelming, from children inside the home, from emails that documented not only the catheters, the shaving of their heads, the burns that were left on these children when Ms. Solander poured scalding hot water on them, the bemoaning by Ms. Solander over the fact that she wasn't being financially rewarded enough and it wasn't worth it to Mr. Solander. You had those. You had workers and therapists that expressed their concerns, not only for the Solander children, but also the other foster children that were in the house. You had babysitters that were concerned about how the Solander girls were treated. All of this information the jury had. And it's not really a shock at the end of the day why they found Ms. Solander guilty of all 46 counts. Because no matter where you looked, people were witnessing the egregious things that Ms. Solander was doing to children she chose to make her own. She didn't have to adopt them, but she did. And this is how she treated them. And the jury said, you know what, this was all abusive.
Okay.
With that,
I did have one question.
Justice Silver.
And I'm not sure if this was in there. Maybe I missed it. Did she receive more money if she adopted them versus foster? I was just curious why she adopted versus continue fostering.
You know, that's an interesting question, and I don't know that question as to why she made the choice to adopt was ever really clear. What came out through trial was you had a number of family services workers talk about, either through email correspondence or through personal talking conversations with Ms. Solander, where she was seeking to have children designated as kind of medically sensitive. Mm-hmm. And then additionally, you had emails where Ms. Solander was talking about, you know, this isn't really financially worth it to deal with, when she was communicating with Dwight. So there was, in part, a financial motive that the state believes. But it isn't clear as to why she ultimately decided to adopt these particular girls. But there is no doubt that the medical sensitivity was an issue. And one of the things that also came out was, you know, once you would take one of the Solander girls to one of these specialists and claim, oh, well, she's got von Willebrand's disease, or this one has Crohn's disease, and they weren't finding anything, the jury heard how she left that doctor and then went to another one and raised new issues. And she was constantly looking for another physician to kind of find this, these designations, these illnesses for illnesses that were just never there. So that was just additional evidence that that the jury had to consider when evaluating the credibility of these children and whether or not all of this behavior was abusive.
Okay, any more questions from the court? Mr. Hammer, thank you very much. Okay, we'll go back to the appellant. Mr. Figler.
Thank you. There was no evidence that there was any additional money for the adoption, but instead there was a suggestion that these children had bonded with the Solanders and that there was a threat that they would be dispersed and not be able to stay together as sisters if there wasn't the adoption. Mm-hmm. And that was the motivation out of love and respect for the children that fostered the transition to adoption. What I did want to also respond to was that the instruction that was given was not the instruction that was either ordered by this court or that was consistent with the language of the subsequent fix in 2015 by the legislature. Again, the court sua sponte added ad hoc a new word, legitimate, into there. We took our language directly from page 8 of this court's decision, talking about all the different aspects of exception to the explicit language of the statute. So when we talked about clinical examinations or domestic parental functions, when we talked about medical, healthcare, and hygiene procedures, when we talked about using a device in the way that it's intended, and to talk about a potential mistake of fact, all that was discarded in the spectrum of what was appropriate by the district court, and instead the district court sua sponte and by the request of the state inserted legitimate in a way that was neither defined nor was it appropriate given the application of the statute. And I appreciate the good faith exemption, but the good faith exemption shouldn't even be there. Honestly, if there is any medical purpose, and here there is all the evidence that this was consistent with the usage of that device. We're not talking about sticking a catheter into the rectum. Indeed, if your honors do not reverse this these convictions, what you're doing is encouraging prosecutors who are overzealous to look at any situation, an obstinate child feigning illness to not go to school, frustrating and angering the parent who then threatens a rectal thermometer and then uses the rectal thermometer saying, aha, you were faking all along. Is that a legitimate medical purpose? But that is something utilized all the time under this expansive approach. And honestly, this was an expansive approach to every aspect of this case. This should have been a very narrowly construed, given the fact that they were experimenting at the DA's office to push the parameters of child abuse, neglect, and sexual assault. And they did it unfettered. So now we have all these convictions. This woman is in prison for the rest of her life on something that was intended by her to be medical to get that urine out. That's my time, unless your honors have additional questions.
Okay, any questions for Mr. Figler? Justice Stigler.
Chief, may I ask a quick?
Sure.
Okay. So, Mr. Figler, don't legitimate and reasonable coexist? Because if it is not a legitimate medical procedure, it's probably not reasonable. I mean, we're going in a circle here. It's got to be reasonable and good faith that a legitimate medical procedure is there. Don't they knock each other out? I mean, how does it change that?
With due respect, Your Honor, this court's actually dealt with this issue back in the 1990s. None of these are elements. The reasonableness, the good faith, they might be implicit in many statutes, but they're not explicit here, nor should they be, because we don't want to interfere with the parental function, especially when dealing with a tool used in the way it's designed. I'll address the court. It was cited in the briefing to the McNair decision. There, somebody came into a doctor complaining of concerns that had nothing to do with the vagina, and there the doctor inserted his fingers into the vagina. It was completely unrelated. There could be no medical purpose for that, none. And I believe that's the standard. And this court made special note to admix in the fact that Dr. McNair was satisfying his sexual gratification, and therefore you were not going to apply an exemption to the sexual assault. I would say the converse is true. Reasonableness, good faith, those are all very important concepts in the idea of due process. But when specifically talking about a parental function under these circumstances, absolutely, if there is any evidence that it was a medical use, then the statute should not apply, and the jury should have been instructed as such, and our instruction following this court's direction would have done that. But again, you're going to have this situation over and over again where an overzealous prosecutor goes in with no jury instruction, and these concepts of reasonableness, legitimacy, et cetera, are going to be inserted and come up with these very unsupported, unsustainable results.
Mr. Figler, what effect do you think that the count involving sticking the stick in the vagina has to play on the others as far as whether this is legitimate medical or bona fide medical purpose, whatever you're going to say, but just, and we'll delete those words and just say for a medical purpose versus sexual assault. I mean, doesn't that count play a role, perhaps, in the factual finding of what happened here? I mean, you have a count of a stick.
Understood, Your Honor. And there were a lot of fantastical counts that were approved by the jury, including the licking the urine after it was disavowed, as Ms. McAmis stated. Now, understand, there is no argument that putting a paint stick, if it happened, is the type of medical use exemption to the sexual assault statute, and that's more in line with this court's cases. I appreciate that. We also argued that there was insufficient evidence and non-credible evidence that that even occurred. And I appreciate Your Honor's distinction. That's a very important distinction. That not to concede that it actually happened, but it would be a different analysis under the statute, as Your Honor said in the order of this of reversal of the dismissal from the district court. So I appreciate the nuance there, but again, there was so much bad act evidence, so much bizarre behavior that was put in. I think the jury would believe anything that was suggested by the state, especially as they testified from the witness stand. I mean, this was a chaotic trial that should have been very measured and narrow, given the fact that the state was attempting to expand criminal culpability for statutes, both sexual assault and child abuse, that had not been attempted before. This is very dangerous precedent that the state engaged upon.
But you can have both child abuse and sexual assault. It happens all the time in the same information. Part of the fact that somebody is sexually assaulted, that's within the realm of child abuse. They have different elements.
But typically not with a medical tool used in the way that it was designed to use. And again, the state wants to point to this bag of urine, if that even really happened. If that child was retaining that amount of urine and they didn't do something about it, I'm sure this prosecution would charge them with neglect on that. So it was a damned if they do and damned if they don't. But the bottom line is they used the medical tool in the way it was designed and no other way. So with regard to that aspect of those counts, they absolutely must be dismissed. I'm not saying you can't charge a parent with sexual assault, but not under these circumstances and certainly not with that instruction.
Okay, any further questions from the court? Okay, thank you all very much. Mr. Hammer, thank you for your excellent argument on it. I think Ms. McGrambis, thank you very much as well. Also want to thank Mr. Figler especially. I mean, I was thinking I'm concluding my 24th year on the court. I'm thinking of many, many, many arguments he's done before me, and they're always outstanding. You know, he's certainly a role model for a great attorney for people to follow. So I don't know if we'll have any more cases, Mr. Figler, before I leave, but thank you again for always outstanding job you do in your cases.
I appreciate that, Justice. On behalf of the law firm of Christina Weldeveld, who is fostering this, we are all very thankful of your time and patience with this matter.
Okay, thank you as well. Okay, well, the court will be in recess till 1:30 this afternoon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.